Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in made history in April when they met at the line that divides the two countries. It was the first time in more than a decade that leaders of the two countries had met. The two each crossed the border into the other's country, shook hands, posed for pictures. They signed a treaty that ends the 65-year Korean War, and they agreed to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Washington Post foreign reporter Adam Taylor has been covering the April summit and its aftermath. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's been happening since the summit in April?
Well, I mean, there's two fronts to this. One is I think of it a three fronts. First off, there's the inter-Korean side of things. Then, of course, there's the preparations for the Trump-Kim summit, the U.S.-North Korea summit. Mm-hmm. And then finally, of course, we saw today that Kim made a second visit in 6 weeks to China, which is, again, a good indication of how important North Korea views China's role in this, and probably that China will play some sort of role in the upcoming U.S.-North Korea talks as well.
What's the next step after this? Is the next step the Trump-Kim meeting that has not yet been specifically scheduled but is coming?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on the inter-Korean side of things when they're talking about potential economic help that South Korea could give North Korea, things like they're talking about direct flights and stuff like that. And none of that's possible without changing the sanctions on North Korea. And that isn't possible in turn without the United States getting involved. So I think right now, a lot of people, the observation with the inter-Korean summit was that really it was setting the stage for the Trump-Kim summit. Of course, South Korea isn't a party to the armistice of 1953, so that's one of the major sort of symbolic things that could happen, and that Seoul would need Washington to really sort of get on board with and to sign a permanent peace treaty.
Wait a minute. Let me. South Korea was not a party to the armistice.
Yes, because it was signed between North Korea, China, and then the United Nations forces that were led by the United States.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the treaty? What is the significance of what they did sign a couple weeks ago?
A lot of it's very symbolic. The agreement they signed at the inter-Korean summit, sort of you read through it and it's stuff like to agree to work together towards denuclearization, to agree to family reunions or to work towards family reunions, to agree to work towards economic development, things like that, which actually, when you look at inter-Korean summits in 2000 or 2007, the language is quite similar. So you have to wonder a little bit, and this is what sort of skeptics are saying, what's really different about this time? The big difference is the symbolism and the fact that this comes before a Trump-Kim summit, and also that that now North Korea, with its rapid advancements in its weapons technology, it's now negotiated from a position of strength, and so maybe it won't. These agreements can be taken more seriously now.
You wrote about the issue of the 28,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. You said the troops are a divisive issue in both the North and the South. Why is it a divisive issue in the South?
I think you can see in sort of any country where there's another country's military that occupies large areas of land and affects the local economy in ways. You see this a lot in Japan as well. People don't necessarily want to house American soldiers. It's just it's a fact of life, and these bases do kind of disrupt South Korean society in positive ways and negative ways, depending on your political outlook. And polls do show that probably the majority of South Koreans want these bases to stay. It's always going to be a complicated issue. And it's notable that Moon Jae-in is of the sort of left wing of Korean politics as well. So it's something we'll have to listen to, the South Koreans' voice in the future, particularly if tensions on the peninsula do get better and things get less tense. Then what do South Koreans think about continuing these bases there?
We're talking about North and South Korean relations this hour. Right now, I'm talking with Adam Taylor, foreign reporter for The Washington Post. If you have questions or comments coming up this hour, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll have a couple of experts on these issues coming up later on in the hour. Adam, President Trump has said, not just in relation to Korea, but in other countries where there are U.S. troops stationed, that he thinks those countries should start ponying up, helping pay the freight, that kind of a thing. I understand that South Korean taxpayers already have footed the bill for a big presence in South Korea of U.S. troops. How has that sat with South Koreans?
Well, yeah, and it's one thing that is kind of politically divisive. I mean, for example, the new U.S. base in South Korea, Camp Humphreys,
yeah.
I think that was funded something like, I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but I think it's something like 90% South Korean funded.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially to move U.S. troops out of this sort of prime Seoul real estate. And that's a huge, huge burden to pay. And, you know, when you think about it in some ways, you know, wherever these soldiers are, the United States has to pay some money. It doesn't matter if they're based in Arizona. The United States pays their salaries and pays for the base. So actually, you know, there's an argument that in some ways, having them based in South Korea, where due to precedent of the years, the South Korean government has ended up ponying up quite a lot of money for them, particularly when it's sort of geopolitically quite strategic to have them in that location, not just for North Korea, but also for China and Russia as well. You do sort of wonder, you know, Trump's arguments about the value for money of having these troops abroad. It's a lot more complicated than the way he describes it, certainly.
Right. So I wondered about the U.S. position on retaining a presence in South Korea. Is there anything significant that we know that in that regard?
Well, the New York Times reported last week that Trump had asked the Pentagon to look at options for you know, withdrawing troops, and it wasn't totally clear if this was, you know, downsizing or a complete withdrawal. Certainly a complete withdrawal would be, just in terms of logistics, it'd be very complicated, and you know, that probably is something you would want to start thinking about how actually that would work at some point. But John Bolton, National Security Advisor, came out with a very strong denial of that, so perhaps it's inaccurate or misunderstood somehow. Certainly in the past, it's something that both political and military leaders have always pushed back upon. One big question, though, is whether, you know, current troop levels would stay the same. Would that change? That's something I think I would be watching more than whether there'd be a complete withdrawal.
John Bolton, speaking of whom, he was a player in the Bush administration when it came to the Koreas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is he a happy presence on the scene there? What do the South Koreans and the North Koreans think about his new role there?
Well, I know. So bear in mind, this was in 2003 or you know, around then, that he was really playing a big role in Korean negotiations. And at the time, I think I forget the exact quote, but North Korean state media called him human scum and a bloodsucker, which is sort of typical North Korean state media language, but it's unusual to, he was an undersecretary of state at the State Department then. It's unusual that someone at a relatively low level would get that direct insult thrown at them. The big thing was that he went to Seoul and had given a speech where he had outlined, you know, the many ways that North Korea commits human rights offenses and things like that. And what was unusual about his speech is that he had sort of personified it. So it was all directed at Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, and at that point the leader of North Korea. And, you know, he was and he is a revered figure in North Korean life. So to the North Koreans, that was incredibly insulting. That said, you know, that was, 15 years ago now. And we've seen that, you know, the president of the United States now insults the leader of North Korea and vice versa. And that doesn't seem to have slowed down the hopes for the upcoming summit. So, you know, perhaps in hindsight, you know, that doesn't matter so much. And the big thing I think I would point to as well is, like, you know, since leaving government that time and before returning, John Bolton was, you know, sort of a talking head. He was always appearing on Fox News and mm-hmm. writing op-eds and things like that. And he was openly suggesting things like regime change in North Korea, which certainly plays into the North Korean idea that the United States isn't a reliable negotiating partner. Even since entering government, he mentioned that, I think it was an interview of Fox News, he mentioned that perhaps the denuclearization plan for North Korea could be based on the model that was used to get rid of Libya's nuclear weapons program. And obviously, that didn't work out so well for mm-hmm. General Gaddafi. And North Korean state media has actually brought up the Libyan example, along with the Iraq war, which also John Bolton obviously played a role in advocating, as examples of how the West can't be trusted and why it needs to have its nuclear weapons. So, I mean, at the very least, in sort of a rhetorical, argument-based way, having Bolton there sort of strengthens a lot of the arguments that North Korea makes, and probably does strengthen some of its, like, genuine anxieties as well.
The South Korean government has said that the issue of U.S. troops is a matter for Seoul and Washington, not Pyongyang. Does the North have any leverage when it comes to these discussions, though?
It's hard to say. I mean, President Moon has said that Kim did not bring up the issue of withdrawing troops from South Korea mm-hmm. When they met a couple of weeks ago. And that is kind of an important shift, if it's true, because that has been something that that North Korea has been quite adamant about in the past. And there's a whole issue, you know, when we talk about denuclearization, the United States tends to think of that in terms of you know, North Korea destroying its nuclear weapons and getting rid of its nuclear weapons program. When North Korea talks about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, it quite often seems to be using a broader definition, which could include the nuclear umbrella, which is how Washington protects South Korea and Japan in East Asia, or it could even mean something as big as withdrawing troops. It has been, you know, North Korea is watching Washington closely, and they must have noticed that Trump seems to have an aversion to the idea of paying troops to be stationed in other countries, for all appearances, the protection of that country rather than U.S. Mainland. But so you have to wonder if they will try and push Trump in that direction somehow. It's hard to say.
Over the weekend, I think it was North Korea issued a message that it wasn't the United States, that Trump should not be taking credit for this apparent reconciliation between the Koreas. There's been talk bandied about the Nobel Peace Prize for President Trump. What of that? How much credit? What are they saying about how much credit the United States government should take in any of this?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Nobel Peace Prize idea was that President Moon of South Korea suggested it, and I do think you've seen he's been very savvy at courting Trump and giving him a lot of the credit for mm-hmm. this. And I think a lot of observers would probably say, actually, you know, President Moon probably deserves a lot of the credit for this. He's really taken what seemed like a bad hand and seems to have turned it to his advantage. And suddenly the big issue is, you know, to what extent did sanctions and diplomatic isolation push North Korea towards this? I think it's fair to say that the sanctions pushed both at the sort of U.S. government level and also the United Nations level by the Trump administration have gone far further than anything else in the past. It seemed hard to believe they wouldn't be having any sort of economic effect on North Korea. At the same time, North Korea did make genuine strides forward in its missiles and nuclear weapons program over the last year. And, you know, in his New Year's Eve address, which was where Kim first brought up the idea of a sort of inter-Korean summit, he was basically saying, you know, we have weapons now. We have, you know, a successful nuclear weapons testing program. We have missiles that could reach Washington if we wanted to. We're ready to go to the negotiating table from a position of strength. And so, you know, it seems likely that at least one of those arguments is halfway right, probably both of them. It's hard to say exactly. I think that fair to say in hindsight that the Obama administration's tactic of strategic patience, i.e. basically just leaving North Korea alone, hoping the problem would go away. In hindsight, that doesn't seem to have been the greatest strategy in the world, and actually sanctions and diplomatic pressure seem to have at least brought the issue to the forefront. But it's hard to know how things would have gone differently with a different U.S. president in office.
And then finally, I mean, is there any sense about when this next summit will occur, when Trump will meet with the leader of North Korea?
Well, as you know, Trump said Friday, I think, he said that the date and the location has been set, and we haven't really heard anything since then. Trump has brought up the idea of hosting it in the DMZ, which was the same place that Moon and Kim met last month. And, you know, there's obviously quite a lot of logistical reasons that would make sense. The other option that seems to be bandied around a lot at the moment is Singapore. There was some sort of discussion of whether Kim would go that far and whether he'd be comfortable using his sort of old Soviet-era North Korean plane to make that journey, but then he just flew to China on one of those planes. So presumably that's a sort of symbol that maybe that is possible. Date-wise, we don't really know. What we do know is that President Moon is coming to the White House on May 22nd. So it certainly seems like it'll be after that, which brings us to the idea that it could be early weeks of June. There were some reports in the South Korean press that actually, you know, the agreements for the talks are still ongoing, and there's still sort of stuff to be worked out about the boundaries of what is being discussed. That wouldn't surprise me, but it's a lot to organize. I wouldn't be surprised if it takes a while to get the date out there.
Okay. Adam Taylor, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Adam Taylor, foreign reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about, of course, the Korean Peninsula and softening of relations between North Korea and South Korea and maybe the United States. So stay with us. We'll get back to the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. North and South Korean leaders met for the first time in more than a decade at the end of April. During the historic summit, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korea's President Moon Jae-in signed a treaty to end the 65-year Korean War and agreed to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Associate Professor of Politics and Government at Ohio Wesleyan University, Dr. Ji Young Choi, just returned from Washington, D.C., where he was learning more about the changes in the Korean Peninsula. He joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Also with us is Associate Professor of History and Director of the Institute for Korean Studies at Ohio State, Mitchell Lerner. Welcome back.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can learn about the history of the two Koreas at the Old Worthington Library on May 14th from South Korean native Dr. Ji Young Choi, my guest here. Visit our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. Can we briefly go back in time a little bit and just review why this all happened in the first place? The origins of the Korean War. It technically started with an invasion of South Korea by the North. 5 million lives were lost. Every time I look at that number, it's kind of shocking because it really only lasted 3 years before the armistice was signed. Why did it start? What do we know?
Yeah, definitely the start of the Cold War was one of the main causes.
The Cold War, yeah.
Yeah. The Soviet Union, after the war, moved to the Korean Peninsula and occupied the Northern Territory, and the United States was not prepared and then proposed a temporary division of the Korea, but
and that was the armistice?
No.
Gotcha.
Actually,
okay.
The division happened in 1945, before the Korean War. So it was the start. But problem is it became nearly permanent because the start of the Cold War aggravated the relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States. And originally they tried to reunify through peaceful means, but failed. And then Kim Il-sung visited Moscow and Beijing, met Stalin and Mao Zedong, and under the support of Soviet Union, and China, he decided to invade South Korea to unify using military forces.
Okay.
So I think the history is particularly relevant here. And we in the West, we in the United States, tend to look at Korea as two separate and distinct countries, North and South Korea. And certainly that's been true since their division in 1945. But the reality is there's a long history of centuries of this being one country, unified people with really great national pride and ethnic spirit. They've had a common language. They had early political systems. They had great advance in terms of technology. And so when we look at this and we start to question the idea of reunification, we have to understand that even today inside Korea, even in South Korea, which is a great American ally, there is still a sense that this division in 1945 was sort of artificially imposed on them. And what essentially happened in this nation that had been one country forever in the early 20th century is occupied by Japan. It's a brutal and ruthless occupation. And many of your listeners no doubt know the stories of the comfort women and human experimentation that are done on the Koreans. And then when Japan is defeated at the end of World War II, the critical question becomes, what are we going to do with this country? Well, the Soviets have their eye on it. The United States has their eye on it. And the United States, very sort of arbitrarily and without much consultation or expertise, arbitrarily divides the country in half at the 38th parallel in 1945. And the supposition is this will just be temporary and we'll reunify, and there's some sort of half-hearted efforts to do so over the next couple of years. But really by 47 and 48, that division is permanent. Each side sort of digs in. The Soviets take control in the north. They prop up their leader, Kim Il-sung, who's, of course, the first of the three Kims that has ruled in the north. The United States props up its system. And then, as Ji-young said, the conflict breaks out in 1950. There's a sneak attack by the North Koreans across the 38th parallel. What we have in 1953 then is simply a military armistice. It's not an actual peace treaty. And over the decades, this is something that the North has constantly pushed for, but left the peninsula technically in the state of war that, you know, and this is one of the reasons I'm skeptical of the agreement right now. Since the end of the war, there's been lots of flare-ups, 1968, 1976, where things got really bad. There's also been lots of times where things got really good, or at least seemed to be getting really
good.
When
families were reunified or let to
visit. Right. So you can go back to, you know, in 2000, there's the first inter-Korean agreement where the two sides actually meet, and they produce this very forward-looking document, which is the basis of much of the Panmunjom Declaration that we're looking at now, and it promises all the same things, family exchange and work towards limiting the possibility of military outbreak and economic ties, and as always seems to happen, it never goes anywhere. So I'm a little cautious about where we are right now.
Yeah, even before the first inter-Korean summit in 2000, in 1972, there was the North-South joint statement, and they agreed to make efforts to achieve reunification peacefully between Kim Il-sung and Park Chung-hee. And also in 1991, there was the joint declaration on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And also, as you know, in 1994, there was the agreed framework between the United States and North Korea. It aimed to freeze North Korea's nuclear programs and to normalize U.S.-North Korean relationships. But the problem is, and of course, you know, 2000, 2007, there were two summits, actually similar agreements and declarations were made. But the problem is they were not implemented for various reasons. Definitely North Korea has the main responsibility, you know, the strategic deception.
They pull back. They don't follow through. Mm-hmm. Is there what, in your opinion, Ji-young, is the difference this time, if any?
Yeah, that's why some people are more optimistic because there are symbolic differences. For example, you know, Kim Jong-un, North Korean leader, for the first time visited the Korean territory, crossed the line. South Korean territory because there are two summits, but South Korean leaders visited Pyongyang. But this time, Kim Jong-un, you know, visited Panmunjom, the joint security area, and stepped on the South Korean territory. And also, it is definitely a positive, you know, difference and some progress. And also Kim Jong-un mentioned that, okay, North Korea do not have really good infrastructures. And he admitted the problems of North Korea. It means that North Korea now, the situation is really desperate.
That they really need this.
Yeah, really desperate.
Now,
because, you know, in my view, South Korea is the only hope on the part of North Korea. Because a lot of high-pressure economic sanctions, even China began to put pressure on, you know, mm-hmm. North Korea. They cut off the oil supply and also, you know, coal export. So the problem is even the leadership began to feel a lot of financial pressures. So in this situation now, there is leftist government in South Korea, and leftist government is willing to support the strong supporter of engagement policy.
They're not as hawkish,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So South Korea is the only hope for North Korea right now.
Yeah, so I know Ji-young isn't all that optimistic, and I'm even less optimistic. I understand that.
I'm not saying that, you know, his intention is really, we don't know the right. Kim Jong-un's mind. Maybe it could be another strategic deception or real, you know, he changed his mind. So we don't know exactly.
Right. And I'm coming down on the side of strategic deception. And I think there's a long history that demonstrates that. I understand the argument that sanctions have played a role here and that they've taken a bite. And by all indications, the North Korean economy is in pretty bad straits. But it's not nearly as bad as it was in 1994,
right,
when 2 million people starved to death, and that didn't impact the Kim family. This is a regime who has such a deplorable record on human rights that my argument would be they don't particularly care if the people in North Korea starve, and that all Kim needs to do is keep a couple hundred people, the elites in Pyongyang, happy, and the regime will muddle through. Now, when you consider that, you know, we focus all of our attention on the North Korean nuclear program and sometimes on the human rights record. What we don't talk enough about is the incredible underground network they have built of illegal activities throughout the world, whether it's counterfeiting, whether it's illegal drug trade.
The government.
Right, the government. I mean, North Korea, to some extent, is less of a traditional nation state and more of an organized crime syndicate. And they have their fingers in absolutely everything, and they generate hundreds of millions of dollars in sort of secret underground revenue that way. I would argue it's enough to keep the Kim family afloat for a while. I think that Kim is playing a pretty brilliant hand diplomatically in the extent to which he has sort of isolated the United States. Right? If when Kim meets with President Trump, it doesn't go well, as is very likely, I think, if the United States issues a demand, as President Trump has indicated he's likely to do, a demand for sort of immediate denuclearization of the North or nothing will go forward from there,
then,
and Kim walks away from the table, the United States has sort of come off looking like the bad guy here. Kim has stabilized his relationship with the South. He stabilized his relationship with China, which wasn't very good. And the United States is sort of the one who comes under attack for abrogating what was seemed to be a successful peace process.
Yeah, I agree. As a Korean American, definitely I strongly desire that, you know, genuine and sustainable peace is created in the Korean Peninsula. But we should be able to make a distinction between what we desire and political reality.
Yeah.
The political reality is that there are significant barriers against achieving the goal of peace in the Korean Peninsula. Definitely the lack of trust. The agreed framework failed because of the lack of trust.
Yeah.
And secondly, different definitions of denuclearization by the United States and North Korea, that is another big problem.
The lack of trust, you know, we were talking about that earlier with Adam Taylor of The Washington Post, and he brought up the Libyan scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
When we were talking off the air earlier, we brought up the Iranian issue and that there is significance, there's a connection there, that this sends signals to North Korea that the U.S. can't be trusted.
Yeah. The lack of trust is a relational issue. Definitely, North Korea has the main responsibility.
Because it has the main...
Yeah.
It has abrogated its...
Yeah. But from the perspective of North Korea, the U.S. is not dependable as well because, you know, whenever the change of the leadership... Actually, Washington's policies to North Korea have not been very consistent. When there is the change of leadership, their policies also change. There is always the possibility that Washington can, you know, overturn the previous agreement after the change of leadership.
Because that's a presidential power treaties.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's a relational issue. And how to overcome this issue is definitely, in my view, one of the real issues.
And then the issue of denuclearization and the definitions of what that is.
Oh,
it's different things to different people.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple critical issues here. There's the question of denuclearization. President Trump is demanding denuclearization, by which he means before anything serious goes forward, North Koreans have to agree to give up their nuclear program. Well, when Kim says denuclearization, he never just says denuclearization. He says denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And what he means by that, since the United States has no actual nukes in South Korea, although there are Ohio-class submarines that could wipe out North Korea in moments, what he clearly means is to break up that nuclear umbrella, the American security guarantee that protects South Korea. And the two sides talking against each other that way. Now what worries me, and Adam mentioned John Bolton earlier and Jiyoung as well. So here's something that I throw into the conversation that I find troubling. What I see a lot of people talking about this, and they say, well, what harm can come from talking? Right? It's good that they're talking, and I agree. Absolutely, it's great that they're talking. But John Bolton has such a hawkish record about North Korea. Mm-hmm. And President Trump himself has said some pretty serious things that, you know, might caution one that we might be going down a road towards conflict. That if nothing does come from the talks, then the obvious next step in the John Bolton era may very well be some sort of conflict. Right. So people say, well, what if, you know, what do you have to lose from this? Well, if nothing comes from this, then something bad could very well come from this, because I could see this as a way for the hawkish elements in the administration to say, look, the North can't be trusted. We have to move on to the next step, whatever the next step is. And that can be pretty horrific.
Yeah, let me explain more about the U.S.'s definition of denuclearization.
Yeah.
The Washington uses the term like CVID or PVID. In my view, there's no big difference, but, you know, complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, or permanent, verifiable, and irreversible dismantling. It includes measures against nuclear scientists and technicians, as well as nuclear facilities. So it is designed to disable North Korea from making nuclear weapons again. And also the problem is North Korea has a lot of underground tunnels, facilities. I think it's possible that they can hide some nuclear weapons.
So there'll be a trust issue there no matter what.
Otherwise, you know, even though they denuclearize, they already have know-hows and technologies. If they want, they can make them again later on. So after achieving some economic development, mm-hmm. they can use some financial resources to make those. So that's why the lack of trust is a big issue. And also, as Mitch mentioned, you know, the problem is North Korea's definition is way different. Denuclearization of the whole Korean peninsula, which means that the U.S. also has to give up the nuclear umbrella in South Korea and maybe Japan. And also there is another issue. As far as I know, Washington also demands the dismantling of ballistic missiles mm-hmm. and biological and chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And also North Korea also demands the dismantling of no deployment of strategic assets, U.S.'s strategic assets like B-52 bombers and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and submarines. So Kim Jong-un mentions that, okay, we will pursue denuclearization, but only when certain conditions are met. Those conditions depend upon negotiations. So that's why negotiations are being made right now. So the name of the game is whether they will be able to narrow down their different views and agree upon certain conditions to pursue denuclearization. So it's not an easy task.
Huh. We will continue our conversation about what the future holds for the Korean Peninsula. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also learn about the history of the Koreas at the Old Worthington Library, May 14th, from South Korea native and my guest this hour, Dr. Jiyoung Choi. Visit our website at wosu.org/allsides for more information. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future for North and South Korea. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korea's President Moon Jae-in signed recently a peace treaty to end the 65-year Korean War. They also agreed to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, sort of. Still with us, Associate Professor of Politics and Government and Affiliate Professor of International Studies and East Asian Studies at Ohio Wesleyan University, Dr. Jiyoung Choi. Welcome back. And Associate Professor of History and the Director of the Institute for Korean Studies at Ohio State, Mitchell Lerner. Listeners, again, you can learn about the history of the two Koreas on May 14th at the Old Worthington Library. Dr. Jiyoung Choi will be there to talk about it. Check out our website at wosu.org/allsides for more information. We were talking about denuclearization, the different definitions of denuclearization. Let's talk a little bit about President Trump and how he figures into this whole equation. It seems to me after the New Year's Eve, or was it, I think it was the New Year's Eve proclamation or whatever, the speech that North Korean president or North Korean leader gave, that was when the Rocket Man, or was it the second time that the Rocket Man comments came out of the president on Twitter. How does he play in this? What kind of role does he play, and how much of a difference does he make in the possible outcome?
I think we have to admit that, you know, the current president is very different from previous presidents.
Yeah.
And then we have to admit that his maximum pressure campaign worked at least to some extent to change Kim Jong-un's mind. Or, of course, as now, we don't know exactly. It could be a strategic deception, or we don't know exactly. But at least Kim Jong-un came out and willing to meet, you know, President Moon and President Trump. So maximum pressure and also high-pressure economic sanctions. Economic sanctions lasted for years, but the real sanction, high-pressure sanctions, started last year, and even China began to put pressures on North Korea. And also American military threat, the deployment of strategic assets like nuclear-powered submarines and aircraft carriers. Definitely Kim Jong-un feels a lot of pressures. So we have to give some credit for this.
So we do, but I want to. I think that's a little simplistic to take. We're taking it out of historical context. Your previous guest, Adam from the Washington Post, was critical a little bit of Obama for the policy of strategic patience, and I see that a lot. And I think it's such a dramatic oversimplification of the Obama policy. In reality, strategic patience on the Korean Peninsula in the Obama years consisted of two things. One was a covert program called Left of Launch, which actually was a series of attacks on North Korean missile testing and other kind of covert intelligence operations against their development. While at the same time, it was rooted in the idea that there are internal political pressures on the Kim family, and I think that they were legitimate. From what little we know of life inside North Korea, we know that there is an emerging generation they call the Jangmadang generation, which is the sort of more market-oriented, less tied to the political system generation that's emerging that I think has put a lot of pressure on the regime and the elites inside Pyongyang, and is to some extent responsible for getting the ball rolling in this direction. So I don't doubt that Trump's increase of economic sanctions played a role. I think we have to go back and look at the last 10, 15 years as a whole and see the rising generation inside North Korea that's a result of a lot of pressures and a lot of steps that have gotten us here. The other thing to note about President Trump and the role he plays here, I am a little worried that the North Korean charm offensive has been so successful that they are, to some extent, forcing the United States out of the picture, that Kim has done well in improving his standing with the rest of the world, and that if the talks break down with the United States, what Kim has done is laid the groundwork for a pretty good increased steps in the direction of improving ties between North Korea and South Korea, almost at the expense of President Trump and American influence. So if what happens if the summit falls apart, or if, you know, God forbid, Trump should overreact and there should be a missile strike or some, you know, they've talked a lot about the sort of the bloody nose strategy. Mm-hmm. If any action is taken against North Korea, I think Kim is in a perfect position to say to South Korea, you know, we are still one people. You know, that despite this artificial division of the West, we Koreans are still unified, and it's the West that has divided us and exploited us. And now here is President Trump, who has sabotaged the peace talks. Mm. And there is this sort of anti-American sentiment inside the South Korean political left that is kind of latent but explodes every now and again. And this could really destabilize the peninsula and have serious implications for the United States' position in Korea and in East Asia overall.
Korea, the Korean Peninsula seems a little bit back burner right now because of what's going on with the Iran deal. Probably no one is watching it as closely as the Koreas. What are they looking for?
Well, I think there's a question of whether or not the United States is going to live up to its agreements. Now, there are clauses inside the Iran agreement that allow the United States to withdraw, but they're only if Iran is clearly in material breach of the agreement, which they're clearly not, and there's a certification process that goes forward. So if the United States is simply to wash its hands of an agreement that went through legal processes, There's going to be concern inside the North Korean government that the same thing could happen to any agreement that they reach. And so negotiators who have been dealing with the North Koreans over the last year or two, they're hearing these things over and over again. They're hearing Iran, they're hearing Iraq, they're hearing Libya. They're hearing all of these examples of that reinforce the message inside the Kim regime that maybe we need to keep our nuclear weapons because the United States isn't necessarily trustworthy. And the only way to deter them is with the presence of nuclear weapons.
Hmm. And what about South Korea? I mean, do they have the same feelings that you could, if you don't stick with this deal, it could affect our ability to cut a deal with North Korea?
Yeah, things are very complicated. Actually, it happened during the Roh Moo-hyun period. You know, Roh Moo-hyun, strong supporter of engagement policy toward mm-hmm. North Korea, but without the support of Washington, it was very difficult to be successful. The same thing can happen, actually. Moon is also a strong supporter of engagement policy, mm-hmm. but, you know, at the time, of course, anti-Americanism is not, you know, fixed or constant, but you know, it depends upon the political developments. I hope it will not happen, but it can happen because of our past experiences. So division between Washington and Seoul can be a really big problem.
Yeah, so I was in Seoul not too long ago, and I met with a number of government officials. And one of the things that was most striking to me was that to some, life in Seoul is normal. You know, the North is testing nukes and firing off missiles, and Seoul is just going on with life the way they always have. And when that comes up in conversation, their answer is always that they have lived under threat of North Korean devastating attack for decades. And, you know, North Korea has 5,000 tons of chemical and biological weapons, and they have 10,000 pieces of heavy artillery stationed along the border. I mean, South Korea, the difference between North Korean having nukes and North Korea having VX nerve gas is really not all that significant. So one of the things that I found really striking was a lot of people in ranking positions are saying to me, why does this matter so much now? Right? If the United States has really been the champion of South Korea and our defender and our great inspiration for all of these decades, and yet for decades when North Korea was developing biological and chemical weapons and doing everything else, your answer to us was always, be calm, relax, we'll protect you. And now suddenly they might be able to hit you with a nuclear warhead and, you know, all hell is breaking loose. But what does that say about your genuine commitment to us rather than your genuine commitment to yourself? So there is this sort of underlying question, I think, sometimes in South Korea about how good the United States' word is to defend them and whether or not they're getting more benefits from the American relationship than they are negatives.
What is the importance to the United States in keeping a presence there anyways? I mean, Trump's questioning it. He's questioning about who pays what. But in general, is it what things look like on the outside ultimately?
Yeah. And of course, sometimes there is a conflict between U.S. military bases and local people. You know,
right.
There are
some that happens all over the world.
Yeah, crime issues and environmental problems. But overall, most of Koreans support the presence of the U.S. military forces in South Korea. And also, it is not just, you know, North and South. We have to think about China.
Yeah.
After reunification, you know, after denuclearization, who will protect? I don't think Kim Jong-un will want the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Maybe he can ask for a reduction of U.S. forces and then no deployment of strategic assets. But I don't think he will push the withdrawal. Maybe China wants withdrawal of U.S. forces if China can put pressures on Pyongyang. But I'm not sure Pyongyang will listen to China.
Yeah, and it's something that I worry about. When Trump was making, and he's made many of these statements both on the campaign trail and then once he came into office about how South Korea doesn't carry its fair share of the load and doesn't cough up money, and most of which is actually technically wrong, but that's beside
the
point.
Well, he just generalizes about it anyways, about all the countries.
But South Korean media coverage was really negative. And I mean, I know it would be negative everywhere, but there was really almost a sense of betrayal that they would say this. And the Korea Times and other newspapers really antagonistic about how terrible this was and what it said about the American-South Korean relationship. So this, again, goes to the idea that I worry that if Kim plays his cards right, this could come away with the North and the South Koreans being a lot closer and the United States sort of its influence on the decline.
North Korean leader, we talked a little bit earlier that he received an ebook blueprint sort of for economic cooperation that could link the North Korea with Russia, China, Europe through trade and trains. Let's talk a little bit about that scenario and what we're really talking about there. Is that it seems almost impossible given the closed nature of that society.
Yeah, first of all, there should be no economic sanctions. The UN imposed high-pressure economic sanctions without lifting those sanctions. You know, it's impossible. And of course, definitely, it is a very long-term project rather than short-term project. South Korea developed rapidly economically throughout 1970s and 80s, but there's no more high growth. It is time to find out another engine of growth. I think North Korea is maybe, you know, can provide a lot of opportunities.
It's a market, yeah.
In manufacturing sectors, many small and medium-sized companies can invest, and, industrial complexes can be created, and also infrastructure. Airports, seaports, you know, railways and highways.
But that's sort of a dream scenario, right?
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, it definitely, as I mentioned, it could be a really step-by-step process. And also linking the pipelines from Russia through North Korea to South Korea. So it costs a lot, but, you know, not only South Korean companies, I think many American companies or Japanese, Chinese companies can also join. It is kind of a win-win situation if it happens, not only for South Korea, but also for neighboring countries. But, yeah, as you mentioned, the problem is whether really Kim Jong-un is willing to open its society. I'm a little bit skeptical.
Well, can they do both? Yeah. Can they maintain their, as you put it, kind of their organized crime
Syndicate. So I'm remarkably skeptical. I think Ji Young's absolutely right. This would be great, and the potential is there. But it means connecting with the outside world in an economic way that the Kim family has never indicated that they're willing to do. I know that they obviously need capital and they need resources, but this would be so out of character that it seems unlikely.
Why did North Korea become so closed? What was the impetus
to maintain,
for that?
I think Pyongyang is kind of communist regime, but not just communist regime, it is totalitarian regime. And plus, three-generation dynasty. In a sense, Joseon dynasty lasted more than five centuries until 19th century. In a sense, Joseon dynasty continues through North Korea, hermit kingdom, right?
Okay.
As I mentioned, we are not 100% sure about Kim Jong-un's mind. Maybe Kim Jong-un is really desperate economically and financially, and then gain some concessions and get some financial support from South Korea. And maybe he can delay denuclearization. And after the change of leadership, maybe renegotiate. That is one possibility. Another possibility is Kim Jong-un really wants focus on the economy. So that's why he changed his mind, because what's the purpose of nuclear weapons? It is very difficult to maintain political legitimacy with only nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. considering the unsustainable economic model.
Right, and all well and good, but it just seems to me that the Kims are mostly attuned to political power, and they're not going to do anything that's going to potentially weaken that in any way. I think they'll be happy to cash the checks, but I don't know that they're going to make any significant reforms. So in 2000, the Nomu-hyun government adopted the Sunshine Policy, where they tried this and they opened their doors, and we talked about economic development, and this gave us some joint economic endeavors. But they also kicked in about $8 billion that went to North Korea, for which in the end they really got nothing, because in the end, when push came to shove, the Kim family is determined to remain in power, and that means they're going to do so through brutal repression. And they're not willing to interact too closely with the outside world, because that could call into question their government.
What they do. Mitchell Lerner, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Mitchell Lerner, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Institute for Korean Studies at Ohio State University, and Dr. Ji Young Choi, Associate Professor of Politics and Government, Affiliate Professor of International Studies and East Asia Studies Programs at Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks for joining us as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lots more to talk about. We probably will again after we figure out when the next summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leadership is. So stay with us for that coming up. And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.